Hey everybody, welcome to TCP Talks with Jonathan Baker and Justin Broadley from the Cloud Pod. In this series, we're bringing you interviews with the best and brightest leaders and heroes from the tech and cloud industry.
Good morning, Jonathan. How are you doing this fine day?
Good, Justin. It's got a lot on my mind lately. I am such a chore to deal with sometimes.
Yeah. You know, least privilege, IAM permissions, managed policies, golden standards. There's so much going on in the IAM space. And so I'm happy to tell you that I found an expert for us to talk to. I'd like to introduce Sandy Bird from Sunry. Sandy, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hey, thanks for having me today, guys. I'm Sandy Bird from Sunry Security, as Justin has said. I've been at this kind of IAM least privilege space for about 5 years now, as we built Sunry. And then before that, I was the founder of a company called Q1 Labs and did a lot of security intelligence and log analytics and things like that.
So I think the first thing was, I see Sunry many times, and in my mind, it was Sunry. Is there a little bit of a story behind the name and some clarification around that? Because I think people will probably hear you say Sunry and think it's spelled one way, and it's spelled a little different. So do check the show notes on that, because it is a great great resource. But I'm curious if there's a story.
Yeah, there's always a story, right, behind these things. And when we were starting this company, and we knew we were going, our goal when we originally started this was, if you're going to secure one of these new cloud environments, AWS, Azure, GCP, and you're moving massive amounts of really sensitive data into it, you needed to be able to understand everything that had access to that really sensitive data. That was the premise. And so we were looking for names for the company. And, anything to do with data security and they're gone. Those domains were gone years ago. And so we were looking for something that was interesting. One of the founders of this company is Irish. It's not me, but one of the other founders is. And so we were looking at, other words and other languages. And Sunry, and there's a little fidal on the end of the I, a little accent at the end of it, actually means data in Gaelic Irish. And so that's where the name Sunry came from. We often use it as trivia in company contests. Do you actually know what Sunry actually means? And so that was the original kind of premise for this company when we started it. And then, you start companies doing one thing and then they, the market changes and things dynamically change. And we spent a huge amount of the last, 4 years in Sunry building, least privilege policies and things like that, and trying to get workload identities to least privilege and helping customers with that. Which is why we've become so focused on the identity side of this thing, even though the data side is actually still near to my heart. I enjoy the data security side as well.
That's great. Yeah, it's a definitely interesting little backstory. And then it's always fun when you get these new words that you didn't know have different meanings. So I really appreciate that. So, as we think about IAM, and I think it's probably one of the most complicated parts for someone new coming into cloud to really understand. And then you add in all of the security things that you care about, from SOC compliance, CSA, things. You get into this IAM quagmire, if you will, of roles and permissions, and a lot of complexity, as well as if you're in multi-cloud environments that use AWS and GCP or Azure, they have different implementations. They use similar words. As you've looked at this market and the space, how do you think IAM's evolved? Has it gotten easier, harder, more complicated? What's your take on this ever-changing industry?
When we were starting this company early on and I was looking at the identity models, and I started with AWS and then Azure and then GCP later, so you progress through these things, there's some interesting learnings. I actually, my gut reaction in cloud was, for the first time ever, we'll be able to do least privilege. Because the problem in enterprise, you're like, okay, I want this thing to be least privilege. Well, where's the central logging for everything it does so we could even build a policy for it? It's hard to find those logs that, but in cloud, because there's a bill for everything, they're going to charge you for everything that you ever do and every API you call you have, you actually have this hope that most of the things that are positively happening in the cloud are logged. That's not completely true, by the way, but it's close anyway. So, there was this idea that, from a technical perspective, we could actually get these things to least privilege because we could see what they were doing, at least centrally, for the first time. So that was interesting. Then, of course, you have this kind of interesting thing as you dive into the AWS model, where nothing is as it seems. You have, these policies on the roles and the users, but then you have resource policies on the resource, and then you have these cross account trust things, and which rule wins is not as clear as you would think that it is. And so you have to decode all that stuff. So I think, unbelievably powerful model in AWS, can do amazing things, especially when you get into some of the advanced conditions and stuff in it. But man, for a human to understand what all this stuff is super hard, like really hard. Then you go to the Azure model, which is very different. It's an allow first model. If you have an allow anywheres in the tree, you can do whatever is asked, but there's this hierarchy to the whole thing. And so when you think you want to remove something, you may not even be removing it because something above may have that permission anyway. And so there's a whole nother model to learn there. Again, just as powerful, but yet different. And then GCP is different again. And so you have this kind of, you know, you say, is it getting better? Is it getting worse? It's just different. You know, we have to learn new skills all the time, and these are skills you have to learn. You would love to say that you could, you know, take what you know about AWS and then apply it to Azure, but you can't. They just don't even have close to the same models, right? So you need special kind of analytics for each one.
Yeah, I related the Google IAM stuff when I was trying to learn it as my current job, you know, uses Google quite a bit in addition to AWS and Azure. And, you know, it was sort of the realization I had was like, I need to think about it like Novell group wise, you know, Novell directories versus Active Directory. Like it's the same basic concept, but completely flipped on the pyramid. And so you go from very broad to very narrow, from very narrow to very broad in the case of these two things. And so it does kind of make you go through some mental hurdles to think about how to translate permissions from AWS to GCP and vice versa, and how you need to think about the structure of those, which is, it makes it hard for us as cloud practitioners, but, it's definitely an area where, you know, we look for, hopefully, you know, the vendors and people to make it easier for us over time. But, you know, that's something that's dangerous too, because the managed policies from Amazon are typically overly verbose and, yes, and definitely not least privileged in most of the time. And you get this false sense of security sometimes when you leverage those.
For sure. I always summarize the three clouds as, you know, AWS and GCP are, you deny, if there's a deny anywhere, you lose. Basically, you don't get to do it. Azure is very much similar to Kubernetes in some ways, and an allow first model. If you have an allow, you can do it. And if you think about them that way, that's the starting point for understanding how to decode this stuff as you're looking at it.
You know, I can see cases where it is possible to create the perfect policy if you've got a, you know, stable service which needs very, very restrictive permissions. But I can also see cases where it would always be impossible. And, you know, we chatted earlier about infrastructure as code and Terraform and how, you know, you think you're using one resource to do a simple thing which you would use one API for, but it turns out that the provider has different ideas, and the way Terraform works, it's sort of maybe called three or four different things which are not documented. It's impossible to actually create a policy, and so you're forced to be overly permissive in that case. Are there any other cases where you think the perfect policy is not going to be achievable?
Yeah, we find I always break it between human identities and then workload identities, because I think they're separate. You know, in your scenario of the workload identity or the Terraform rolling something out, it, technically the perfect policy is somewhat achievable, because in that scenario, it has a job, it does it. And so there's lots of problems in that, and some of the things aren't audited, so you don't know that it does them, so you got to make exemptions for that. And then there's some things where your example of you have some API call you're making, you know, you create function or something, but it actually uses a bunch of other permissions that you need to do that, which are not necessarily audited. Pass role in AWS is a good example of that, right? And so you need to know the hierarchy of what needs what to build that policy. But given some history, you should be able to do that. But what breaks is tomorrow. So the problem is that if you're rolling Terraform out, it's because you're updating your application all the time. And inevitably, last week it didn't use an SQS queue, but the team added something where it needs an SQS queue now, and then now you broke something, right? With that perfect policies, it breaks. And so you need a way to quickly be able to dynamically change those types of things. The other thing is a whole bunch of those perfect permissions that you took away probably weren't that sensitive to begin with, right? You know, being able to whatever, I don't know, list the buckets in the account, yeah, maybe it's sensitive, but probably not really from that role that already has the ability to do very sensitive things way beyond that. Human identity is a little different, though. Human identity is hugely sporadic, right, in what they do in life, and they don't deal well with minor inconveniences, I will call it. So if you look at a human identity, even over a long period of time and what they do, be like, okay, well, they only use these three services, and when they use those three services, these are the sensitive things they do, and we give that back to them. Immediately, they will log into the Azure console or the AWS console, and they will browse. Somebody said, you know, Cognito's interesting, or somebody said I should look at Synapse, and they'll just go to the console where Synapse is, and it will break because they don't have any permission to it anymore because you took it all away. Whereas giving them the ability to see the front page and be able to navigate a bit of it probably wasn't going to hurt anything anyway. Just don't give them the ability to poke holes in the network and do nasty things. And so, you know, the perfect policy is always can be achievable. It's probably not the desirable outcome you want in many cases. However, and this is my, I always have an exemption, right? It's like for the most sensitive workloads touching the most sensitive data, there's still an argument you probably should try to get close in those scenarios. So
as we, you know, think about trying to get to more perfect policies, you know, and we're thinking, you know, there's been a lot of tooling that started to come out from cloud vendors, you know, to try to help you do this. And the one that we talked about quite a bit on the CloudPod main show is, you know, Azure's AI capabilities. And, you know, they have a model that I think sort of burns people, which is that, you know, they look at a very small period of time. It's like 7 to 14 days. You know, what did this service role use? What permissions? And so then it basically makes automation to allow your SOC team to remove those permissions that you didn't use in the last little period of time. You know, I always thought that was a terrible plan because, you know, I have lots of apps that I've built over the years. You know, yes, it has these permissions, but on once a month, it needs this other permission where it has to load data into a reporting warehouse, or on a quarterly basis, it needs to do something. And so you run into this problem where, you know, from a very small time frame, you can end up removing permissions that are actually needed. And then when the application actually goes to do the thing it's supposed to do, it blows up in spectacular fashion, which makes my SRE heart cry a little bit. I'm curious, you know, what kind of some of the stories you've seen around, you know, attempts at trying to fix this problem?
Yeah, and I think, you know, any of those scenarios, including the part of the original Sunreach solution that we built, uses these time windows, right? And history is very important. You need big windows. 7 days is not necessarily enough to be starting to take these things away from, and you need to know these patterns. However, what we learned over the years in doing it was there are certain permissions that you probably should be taking away that will not be called once a quarter. And there are other permissions which are, you know, highly likely that they could be called, but are less sensitive in some ways, and so can probably be left. And I use the, in AWS you have Direct Connect, right? And in Azure, I forget what the equivalent of Direct Connect is, but you can create these, you know, networks from your corporate enterprise in deep into the cloud. It's highly likely that the quarterly report is going to use that permission, right? It's hugely sensitive. It's only called once when you wire the thing up, and it's never called again after that. And so, you know, those are the types of things that, you know, you could actually quite easily take away. When we talk about later some of the work that we've been doing in this cloud permissions firewall, that's how we look at those permissions. Like, those are really sensitive, and they are very infrequently called, and they should be removed from that perfect policy. But leaving the fact that it's going to need to, you know, read data to the storage account, and it hasn't done that in the last 7 days, maybe we need to leave that, right? And so that's the, you can start to make a decision on these individual permissions saying, you know, how frequently is this called? Is it something that could be called infrequently that may be needed, versus this is truly a once and done scenario? You don't create internet gateways every day, right? And so you can use those to kind of balance that out.
I think another issue I see a lot in my experience, one of the places we see sprawl of permissions is break glass access for, you know, SREs or other operational people who urgently need permission to do something. It gets added in the middle of the night, perhaps without any kind of audit trail or documentation, and then, you know, they end up with those permissions in perpetuity because there's no process in place to go back and revoke those.
Yeah, we definitely see, and again, we can sometimes, as you say, it's an intentional break glass account. It's there to be used in those middle of the night scenarios, in which case it's just infrequently used except then. And then you have the second part of that, which is, you know, during that use, possibly other roles and other, you know, identities are created with excessive permissions because they need to get the job done quickly, and then no one ever goes back and cleans them up. So you have this kind of two scenarios. And one of the reasons we started to really look at this new solution in controlling these things centrally was that most likely when that break glass account happens in the middle of the night, it needs to do a lot of troubleshooting, and it may need to make a few changes. And in that scenario, if it creates new identities that are just overprivileged but they don't use sensitive permissions, there probably needs to be a secondary approval. And as long as that team can approve them very quickly, they can still get that job done. However, again, stats are really interesting. We look across our customer base today, out of all the things that end up with those really sensitive permissions, right? They end up with EC2 star or Lambda star or, you know, the storage account editor or something in Azure. Only like 8% of those identities actually use the sensitive parts of them. The other 92 just sit there in the cloud forever, never being used. And so most likely during that, you know, break glass scenario in the middle of the night, somebody's troubleshooting, they have to create some stuff, they over-permission it. If we control this centrally, the sprawl doesn't happen, right? Because again, you keep that locked down because there's never been that approval to say, I need to actually press the button because it has to create an internet gateway or a direct connect or whatever it happens to be. And so we lock those down and keep them locked down. And I think that's a better way to do it than trying to make sure every policy is perfect and you don't have to wait the 90 days to see what it does, right? Or whatever the window you're going to use, 7 days, 90 days, whichever. It's instantly protected. But the soon as it actually does something sensitive, you can basically enable that, and then it just continues. And it's a faster way to get to that kind of least privileged state doing that model.
We talked about the problems that we have. What's the solution?
Look, I think one of the things that's super interesting that we're working on right now, and we're just releasing this, we call it a cloud permissions firewall. It's a really interesting name for it because what it does is that it takes those really sensitive permissions, right? You take the 10,000 permissions and 10,000 plus permissions in any cloud provider, AWS, Azure, GCP, isolates the ones that are really sensitive, the ones that can do real damage to your cloud, the things that, you know, I always use like the pre-signed URL examples out of some of these services where it doesn't matter how you have the networking set up, it doesn't matter how you have the security group set up, you create one of these pre-signed URLs and you just poke a hole from the outside internet into your cloud when you do it, right? These are the really sensitive permissions. And so we isolate those. And by looking into that past for what uses them, we find the exemptions, right? The things that really need access to these sensitive permissions. And we build a centralized rule that says deny by default. Just deny the really sensitive permissions by default. And put an automatic exemption in for the things that actually needed them over that long window of time. And so the cloud doesn't break. It continues to run the next day. But you remove that 92% of permissions that were sensitive that have never been used by those identities instantly. And they're instantly, all net new identities that show up are instantly protected. But anyone who's played with SCPs and, you know, these kind of centralized control mechanisms in cloud knows that, well, that's super risky though, because now when something needs an exemption to that, man, we've got to go find the person that has the permission to change them and all of these things. And so that can't be the way that these permissions are granted back, but it's the thing that can centrally deny them. And so we've built this scenario where, again, using native cloud services, we know when anything gets denied these permissions. And as soon as they get denied the permission, we just send a note to the team that's approving it over whatever mechanism they use to do their work, Slack, Teams, you know, any other chat ops platform. Send them a note to say, you know, do you believe the Terraform role that's deploying this actually needs permission to create an access key on an IAM user? So yes, it's part of its job. You say approve, you run the thing again, and it runs perfectly with the new sensitive permission. But even though it may have been granted star, if it didn't need to do that, it would never be asked and therefore would continue with the smaller set of permissions that it had all the time. And so you end up with this kind of no disruption model to the teams. They get permissions within minutes when they need them, right? You know, you see the deny, you send them a note, they approve it, they get the permission back. But you don't leave this massive sprawl of permissions sitting out there that are really sensitive all the time. But there's definitely, you know, we go back to that perfect policy where that's not the perfect policy. But it's a heck of a lot better than what's generally being deployed in a lot of these cases, right? And so it really reduces that risk footprint.
It's a really interesting approach to solving, you know, a fundamental problem, which is, you know, giving those least permissions to the right way. And then when you do need them, you know, how do you rapidly grant them access without requiring a new code deployment or a new push? And so it's really interesting approach to solving a real problem that especially exists in companies trying to do infrastructure code and these overly permissive roles that had to get created to support that. You know, you mentioned roles that are permissions you consider sensitive. You know, can you give us some examples of what those might look like off the top of your head?
Yeah, we over the years have built, you know, this massive decision tree as to what's considered sensitive and what's not. And, you know, generally, anything that grants anything more access than it had before is sensitive. So, you know, attaching a policy as an example to a role, that would be very sensitive. creating some form of resource-based access control. So if you think about creating a storage account key in Azure, you know, you're basically opening up that storage account to anything that has the key. So that would be very sensitive. I used the example earlier of things like creating pre-signed URLs that bypass the network rules. Those are very sensitive. And this is what's really tricky about cloud permissions. You can't necessarily trust the names and words of those permissions to understand what they do. I always use the IAM examples in AWS. You have, you know, create policy. Well, is that sensitive? It's kind of sensitive, but if you don't attach the policy to anything, it's not really that sensitive. And then you have something like, you know, create role, create trust relationships. Those actually get much more sensitive. But then you have other things that say, like, create IAM, you know, entitlements report. That's not actually sensitive at all. You're just seeing what the entitlements are. And so you can't use the words and the permissions to determine if they're not. You have to make decisions based on what they actually do. And so we have, you know, whatever, 5 years of experience in doing this, and we have these massive decision trees that decide. And then, you know, back, I think it was Jonathan was talking earlier about this kind of weird concept where you have a permission to do something, but it calls an API, say, and that API needs four other permissions to do it. Those may not be themselves the sensitive permissions. It may be one of those other five that it's calling that are sensitive, right? And so we have to make sure you have this linkage to say, yeah, it doesn't seem like, you know, create users is sensitive, but if the create user also has an access key associated with the create and is also attaching an administrator policy, now that it is, right? And so you use these decision rules to figure this out. We try to kind of map them to something that people are familiar with, like a MITRE framework. So you can say, you know, if somebody had this, they could create persistence in the account, or if they had this, you know, they could exfiltrate data if they had this. So we try to use a way to use the MITRE kind of tactics to categorize them so people are familiar with them. But it is a big kind of decision tree that we go through to figure out if they're sensitive or not.
I think one of the things that concerns me the most, I love managed services in the cloud. The way they're implemented has changed a lot. Amazon added the service roles a few years ago, which meant we could turn access off from those services back into our own resources. Google's model seems to be heavily oriented around deploying services in service VPCs and then adding peerings. And, you know, deploying a service like Vertex, for example, it may be a single API call, but it creates a service account which then has a whole host of other permissions. Can this tool also manage and sort of scope down the permissions that those service accounts, which were really a one-time use function, can it also scope down the permissions that they have in the long term?
Yeah, there's two parts to that. One is, can it scope them down? Yes. And so the great thing about those, you know, using the centralized cloud mechanisms for putting these controls in place is they apply to all things in those accounts, including the stuff that the service provider puts in. So they protect them as well, right? And so that's a huge benefit in the solution, is that it doesn't differentiate between which side. And, you know, the exemptions work as well in a similar way. There's also this other thing where they're used initially highly sensitive permissions, right? As you say, you know, it calls one thing that creates this other, identity in the account. Maybe it's a role, maybe it's a service account. It puts it in. That has a whole bunch of permissions that then go and roll out a whole bunch of infrastructure, but it kind of does it once and then never does it again. We have this secondary concept that we call zombie identities. And I hope that catches on in the industry. I love it. You know, zombie identities are basically things that have sat dormant and haven't done anything for some very long period of time, you know, 90 days, 180 days. You kind of configure what that window is. And for the last 4 years of my life, I have been trying to figure out why people haven't removed these, right? You know, we have great ways to detect them. I can tell you that this particular customer has 26,000 identities that they do not use and have not been called in over a year. Like, why are they still there? And what you find out very quickly, if you start to ask the customers, and you guys would be familiar with this in your own jobs, there is this fear that if I remove this identity, I may not be able to put it back the way it was if it was supposed to be important. And I always use the example of, you know, you have something that configured a voice over IP system, and it had a very specific set of permissions on it, and all of the trust relationships for the resources had certain trust relationships, and you delete that identity, and now you've removed all of those specialized permissions, and somebody says, well, oh, we didn't mean to do that. Can you put that back? And you don't know what putting it back means. Or if it had an access key, and that access key was hard-coded into a piece of code somewheres, well, when you've removed that access key, you've deleted the key material, and there's no way to put that key material back. And so people just get really worried that, you know, they're going to break something. And so we came up with a secondary concept for the things that you were worried about. So maybe that's not the service case example, but it's a similar type example where we basically short-circuit them and say, these things can't log in and be used anymore. However, we don't delete the key material. We don't delete the permissions. We leave those all intact. And when you need to reanimate them, reanimate a zombie, kind of a fun word, when you reanimate it, all we do is remove the restriction so it can be used again. And so that way you're not worried about, well, what happens if in 6 months this thing really needs to happen? And my hope with this is, in this new solution, that I finally have a scenario where that if we put these things to sleep, we quarantine them for 12 months or more, and it truly has been 12 months, then Jonathan, you'll be able to say, I think after 12 months of knowing it was never logged in, we can finally delete that thing and get rid of it, right? And we hope this is a softer way to build up history to say, yes, we can finally get rid of this stuff.
It seems to be that security in general has this the same problem of sort of its escalation on one hand. You know, you keep adding new tools, you keep adding new things. It's like, you know, in the airports, you know, we all get x-rayed, we all get scanned. Those things are never going to go away because nobody wants to own having taken away a security measure, which may lead to a vulnerability later. And on the flip side, it's the fear that making that change, you know, to remove an identity or remove a permission will also cause a problem. So I think people are kind of stuck in this very fearful place of not wanting to act in the interests of not having an outage, but at the risk of vulnerabilities in the future.
Yeah, again, and we've seen it in our customer base. We have a great customer, Arch Financial, and they actually were doing I won't call them the perfect policies, but our policies to actually get these things to least privilege and clean up some of these unused identities. And they did about 2,000 of them over like a 10-month period. And they were super happy about this. We're so successful. We have 2,000 things now that are at this kind of least privilege. But you look at that and you look at the time that was used and you ask them where the time was. It wasn't in generating the policies. It wasn't in attaching the policies. It was in team time to prove that what they had done would not break anything and testing it in dev and testing it in, you know, staging environments and then pushing it to production. And then figuring out who owned the role, and like all of the time was in that. It wasn't in the actual, you know, you run some analytics, you get a better policy, you apply it, you're done. That's not where the time was. And so, you know, working with that customer and this new solution that we're doing, they're like, it is insane. We would be able to do tens of thousands of identities in, you know, 48 hours with this, knowing that we're not going to break anything, but we don't have to ask the teams to go fix all the stuff. They can just leave them kind of over-permissioned as they are, and you get this central way to actually deny the really sensitive permissions that we can prove that they weren't using anyway. And if they need them back, within 2 minutes, they can have them back. And it, you know, I think until you've gone through that pain of trying to actually fix 2,000 roles, you don't realize how long it takes to work with the organization to fix them, right? That's where you learn that.
You mentioned the very sensitive permissions a couple of times, you know, mostly centered around data exfiltration, I think is the primary concern at the moment. You know, if I care about other things, can I also use the firewall to restrict other sets of permissions? You know, if I don't want people to create you know extra large instances that cost $180 an hour, can I also apply the same tool to restrict those kind of things?
I'm going to just answer the question in two ways, Jonathan, because there's a, you know, what does a centralized control in AWS, Azure, and GCP allow you to do? And then what does the cloud permissions firewall do? And I'm going to say for the cloud permissions firewall, the first time through this, we've chosen not to implement some of those. That's a great cost one, right? I don't really want people using these really large instances because they cost a friggin' fortune. We've chosen not to go into those individual controls. However, the technology behind what we're using, this SCP control, does actually allow you to do that, right? And so in the first cut out of the gate, we're not going to that level, but it's certainly something that possibly could be added later on. But I would also say that this is a spot where cloud teams should do a little investigation, right? You can write in Amazon and SCP or an Azure policy and attach it at a management group that absolutely will block the use of that. And so one of the things we did and challenged ourselves with in building the solution was we were not going to do anything that wasn't cloud native. So no man in the middle, no putting proxies in, no jump boxes where we record what people are doing and block certain things. This had to be 100% cloud native. And so the way that we've built this cloud permissions firewall, any customer could do the same thing in a scenario where they have that example that you come up with, Jonathan. You say, man, I really don't want people using, you know, whatever, X5, extra large, whatever's, no problem. You can write a rule for that. Yeah, and honestly, you can go to some of these great new generative AI systems and ask how to write that SCP, and it will get close. You should test it thoroughly, but it will get you close to what that looks like. There is a limit to the amount of space in both, you know, Azure and AWS as to how many of these you can have and how big they can be and where they can be attached and all those things. But it really is an effective way of doing it.
Yeah. If I'm using SCPs today as part of sort of, you know, compliance and governance controls, can I still use your product?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, and this is where we can dive into the technical details, because the cloud practitioners on the call will enjoy this stuff, right? So SCPs have these really interesting limits on them. So first of all, you can only have so many SCPs. You can only have SCPs of a certain size. And then you can only attach a certain number of them at each node of your AWS organization. And Azure has similar things around the sizes of Azure policy and stuff like that. So we've actually, one of the things, again, over the years that we've done is we do a lot of discovery of the cloud. So we understand the account structure and we understand how many SCPs you have attached at every point. And in the early days of our company, we started to build a lot of these preventative controls. And so we had built stuff to do kind of compression of SCPs and make them smaller. And so we had a lot of intellectual property and how to do some of that stuff. And so we can actually look at how the customer's laid out today. As you say, you have some of these SCPs already in place for governance. You probably have them fairly high up in the tree or in a zone that's a PCI zone or something. And so you've got all these things on here. We will find the holes in your space. We will figure out where that space is available. And then we will compress the SCPs that we create into those spaces to make sure that they put the right set of controls in place, but do not stop you from using the SCPs you have today. Now, there's always a caveat to that. There's not an infinite number of spaces. Say, as an example, you had 5 SCPs attached at every possible single node. Well, there's no space left for anybody in that case, right? And so, you know, there are limits to it, but in our existing customer base, we've been able to mine this. And what we find is that, you know, customers have a tendency to put SCPs quite high in their trees, but we can use up a lot of space lower in the tree. So we have kind of dynamic ways of stitching that stuff in there so that it's not taking up the space that you've already used.
So, you know, we talked about a really cool technology here. How do I go about implementing this thing? Is it, you know, a month-long implementation process? What does it look like?
It's pretty quick, actually. So what's kind of neat, and I'll talk about separation, Justin, of, you know, the permissions that we need to understand what we need to do, and then the permissions that the cloud operations team or whoever's going to deploy the actual centralized control needs, because they're separate. Our Sunry Security, the SaaS platform, does not need these sensitive permissions into your cloud. So the first thing about onboarding this is we need to understand some history of what's been used before, and we need to understand what identities exist and what entitlements they have. Those are basically the two questions we need to answer. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to onboard at the org level, and we're going to figure out where your centralized cloud trail is, and we're going to start to read some data out of it because we need some history, right? So we're going to go back in time. And the second thing is we're basically going to go through and find, you know, what are the roles and IAM users and their attached policies and, you know, how is SSO set up with Identity Center and what permission sets are there and all of those types of things. So we'll explore the space that you have for that. That process takes anywhere from, you know, we have small demo accounts that you can do that in 12 minutes, and we have very, very large customers with thousands of accounts that actually takes 48 hours. So, you know, it depends on the size of the amount of data that we're reading and those types of things. But within a couple of days, we have that. And so now we know what the space is, right? So once we have that space, then the system comes up and it makes the recommendations. And it says, okay, here are the unused identities that you can turn into zombies. Here are all of the identities that have access to sensitive permissions that have never used them. Here are the identities that actually do use sensitive permissions, and here is the context that they use them in. They use them in this account and not this account. And so we can dynamically create the rule set. When you apply that, so you know, we have the data. At that point, it's just running an analytic to generate the CloudFormation template that's going to roll this whole thing out in terms of controls. You generate that, and then we hand that back to you as infrastructure as code. So in the case of AWS, we use CloudFormation. In the case of Azure and GCP, it's Terraform. We hand that back to you, and then it's your process from that point forward, Justin. You know, if you have the Wild West in terms of maintaining your SCPs, you can just drop this thing into the org account and deploy it, and you're done. If you have a scenario where you need to check these templates into GitHub, you need some PRs on it, and then you need to execute the whole thing using a Git runner, that's your process. You wire that up, but we've given you the template to deploy it. During that part of the scenario, our system's kind of, you know, listening to the cloud using these kind of, you know, security auditor style roles to see when that's deployed. As soon as it's deployed, we now know that we're in that kind of protective mode. And now that we're in the protective mode, that's when those permissions on demand things happen. So if we see, you know, Jonathan, you know, wakes up and tries to, you know, create a new role as an administrator, and he's never done that before, we're going to send a permissions on demand request over to Justin and say, Justin, do you approve Jonathan to do this? You're going to hit approve, and now Jonathan gets a note back saying, go ahead, you're approved, and you can go and create that user in that administrative role. And so it's actually pretty quick to get this thing up and running, right? You know, within a week, you're kind of in a protected state. I don't believe any customer will deploy this in 48 hours and be done. What they'll do is they're going to test this in a development zone, and they're going to get their developers used to this permissions on demand thing where they're, yeah, I can do this thing, and then I can, you know, approve it, and then it's approved. And after they're comfortable with that, then they will roll it out to the whole cloud. But it's a completely different world than trying to say, you know, I have 10,000, you know, workload identities, and I'm going to put the perfect policy on all 10,000 of them. That takes months and years. This solution takes days. And so it's a very different metric in that.
Well, thank you. That's great.
Just one more question. This is always very retrospective. It's somebody tried to access something and it failed, and you sent a note, and then there was an approval and they retried. Is there another way around to work things where if you know you're going to need a permission and you're not sure that you still have it, that we can sort of proactively request the permission to ensure that it happens?
The whole thing, if you think about this, is a bunch of APIs that know about permissions and have a, you know, a request or approval flow. So that's how the under the covers of this lovely UI that you get in this chat ops, there's just a bunch of APIs there. And so we have this kind of interesting documentation that we can give to teams to say, and think about this. So you, in development, you're doing more experimentation, right? So the first time you run it, maybe you don't know what permissions it needs. So you give it star, you run the thing, it bumps into one of these requests, somebody approves it, they try it again. As you've done this, you've actually built the list of things that need to be approved when you go to prod. So now you know the answer, right? You know that, yeah, we're definitely going to have to get an approval for that role because it does something sensitive in this service. And so now what you can do is you can make those requests up front and get the approvals done kind of before everything happens. And so it's all API driven on the side. It happens to use a GraphQL API. It doesn't really matter, I guess, which API it uses, but you can give the dev teams very specific API calls that they can make to kind of get these approved. They still have to be approved. Again, it's an important step to have things approved. But as long as they get the approvals up front, they can just roll this thing out during their deploy window in the middle of the night or whenever they need to do it.
Cool. That's great. I'm really looking forward to getting my hands on it and playing with it.
So thank you very much, Sandy, for coming on. I assume you have a blog or places they can come to on the Sunry website. Where can we send people to learn more?
Look, I think just send them to sunrysecurity.com. As you say, there's a whole bunch of great content there in blogs about how all this stuff works. There is a 14-day free trial for people that want to try it and get their hands on it. And then there's lots of great information in there about, you know, SCPs and sensitive permissions. And if you're interested in IAM and cloud, it's a great website just to learn too.
Fantastic. Yeah. And as a listener of the Cloud Pod, you do get access to that 14-day free trial. You can find the code in our show notes to go get access to that right away. So thanks a lot, Sandy, for coming on. We really appreciate it. Love to have you on again in the future to talk more about IAM. It's a very interesting and, you know, problem space. And, we always have lots to talk about in this one.
Thank you, Justin. It's been great.
Thanks, Sandy. Visit thecloudpod.net to subscribe to the show, join our Slack channel, or sign up for our weekly newsletter. You can also find information on reaching our audience through a Cloudpod sponsorship opportunity. A big thank you to today's guest, and thank you for listening.